You're listening to Face Off, episode 26, recorded July 12th, 2009. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we like to talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com, or if you wish, you can follow us by going to twitter.com/faceoffshow. All right, Mark, we've got a pretty good episode lineup this week. We're both actually really excited about it. We're talking about... Last episode, we talked about some projects that we were working on.
And lots of business stuff.
Yeah.
Lots of business principles.
Yeah. The past two have been pretty businessy, so we're kind of getting back to our
programming.
Our programming roots, especially for the topics. But so let's dig into our web apps. The first one we're going to talk about is Chegg.com.
So Chegg.com. And what is Chegg?
Chegg is a place where students can go online and rent textbooks.
Okay.
So... You and I are both fairly recent college graduates, and I don't know about you, but when I was in college, textbooks are just ridiculously expensive.
Yeah, you pay something like $100, and then at the end of the semester, the university's like, we'll give you $50 for that book.
Oh, if you're lucky, $50.
And then we'll sell it for $75 the next semester.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, it's just a big pain. So I remember, you know, I never sold back any of my textbooks because I was like, well, it's not worth it. It's information I might need someday. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, some semesters I did, and it's like, it's sort of like this, it's almost like a sugar rush of money for students at the end of the semester for, you know, beer money or
like,
whatever.
Screw it. It's $20.
Yeah, exactly. There's, you know, so and that's really what keeps the system going is students are just done with the semester and they say, ah, screw it. I don't want this book anymore. So Chegg is a place you can go on and rent books for a semester, a year, for a month, I think are the three options to rent.
So you don't even have to buy the book?
No, you don't.
You don't have to sell it back. You just rent it.
It's like a book that would cost you $140 is $10 to rent for a semester.
Wow. If I only knew about this when I was going to school.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's some textbooks I think you should get and keep. I have some, you know, some entrepreneurship ones, some consulting ones for some classes I took, especially in upper division classes. But a lot of the classes I took as an undergrad, the book is filled with such basic information. I'll never need it again. And I spent $140 on it and, you know, could get 20 back. But I could have just rented it for $9.
They even let you return the book for free. They will give you a return label.
It's similar to Netflix. You know, it's like the whole point is that shipping does not cost you. And another really cool thing about Chegg is you can sell books that you have. If they have a need for it, you can sell it to them. I'm not sure of how much money they're giving, but, you know, if you have some books already, check to see if you can sell them to Chegg and help out the system. Because really, it's really just kind of goofy. I'm not happy. You know, some of these, I was just looking now, I'm looking at some of these, some corporate finance books. Some of them are pretty pricey to rent for a semester. Some are like up to upwards of $40, $60. But it's still cheaper than purchasing the book.
So I had a question, you know, what if I like the book? You know, you mentioned sometimes you want to save the book at the end of the semester. You think you might want some of the information out of it. I'm looking here, and it says you can actually purchase it if you end up liking it.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. I mean, do they give you like a nice used price or?
Yeah, probably. Depending on the supply and demand and how many books they've got, you know, they're gonna come up with a price. But they give you an option to buy them if you want them. So that's a good way to just rent it for the semester. And if you do feel like that you want to buy it, you can just buy it from them.
Yeah. Exactly. Another thing that Chegg does that is cool is they plant a tree for every book you rent. And so what I'm assuming is they pay like whatever fee to one of these, plant a tree for the Globe organizations. But every time you rent a book, they supposedly donate enough money to plant a tree. So not only are they saving paper by not having, you know, by slowing down manufacturers printing books that people are just going to sell and throw away eventually, they are trying to help by planting a tree every time you rent a book too.
Cool. It looks like they've saved a lot of money so far. It looks like they've got $40 million they say they've saved people.
That's crazy.
Overall.
Because books... what's nice about it is when you go, it says it'll show you the rental price and then it'll tell you the list price. So like I found a book actually that is $90 to rent for a semester, which is pretty pricey. But they tell you right there, the purchase price of the book is $187.50.
Okay.
So I'm assuming it's just based on like the scarcity of the book and how much it costs them to procure the book as well. So I'm sure if you like look for entry-level freshman, you know, books for your class, I'm sure they're going to be ridiculously cheap to rent. I know that the corporate finance book I had, I actually pulled a textbook out at my house and looked it up. It was a book that I paid, I think, $100 or so for. I could rent for $10.
So when we originally started looking at this and talking about it, I was kind of curious, you know, how do they secure the money if it's only $10? And I'm finding here that you, what you do is you actually buy the book for the full price. And then at the end of the semester, you get all the money back minus like $10.
Oh, really?
So that's how they do it.
That's interesting. Hmm. And that doesn't really save you much money then.
Well, you get all the money back at the end of the semester.
Yeah, but still, it's like if you're a freshman in a crunch for...
True. It's like you spend it and then you get it back.
Yeah. I don't know.
You get that sugar money at the end of the semester,
you
though.
Do. You get the sugar... I don't know. Either way... It will save you money. I don't know. I'm not really as jazzed about it, to be honest with you, because I didn't actually get that far into the process. That's not cool.
You're not in school anymore, so we couldn't actually buy a book from them or try it, but.
Yeah. That's a bummer.
I suppose you don't have to be in school to do it.
No, but trying to find out which book you
want to
rent.
But it's mainly textbooks, yeah. So it's
rent for, you know, a semester, which is 125 days, a quarter, which is for, you know, 85 days, or the summer, which is 60 days.
So you're not going to find, like, a novel on here or something.
Yeah. Well, you never know. I mean, English classes, true. You know, do novels. But check it out. See if it's for you. I'm a little disappointed now, I guess. I wish I would have dug into it a bit deeper as to how they actually... charge you and whatnot, because I'm not really that impressed with it, because it doesn't save you, it saves you money, but that's just a business model I don't like.
Yeah, but
I don't like paying and getting a refund. The whole point of them saving me money should be that they should save me money up front.
Yeah, but if you only give them $10, how do they secure, if you don't return the book or your dog eats half the pages out of it?
Oh, charge me more. It's a business problem that happens to any business out in the world anyways. I mean, if you're a business and you give anybody credit in any way, shape, or form, it's a problem that happens anyways. If they don't do it, you should, you know, try and send them notices, and if not, then you report it to a credit agency. I don't know. Not as impressed with this now. Still, net, I guess, net cost is that you'll save money, you know?
Yeah, this is still way better than, well, I mean, some people like to support their local university bookstores, but... let's face it, sometimes the freshman, or, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a freshman or not, but you're going to be strapped in cash, you're spending a lot of money on school, and, you know, this is a lot cheaper than buying them.
Yeah.
And then trying to sell them back to the university.
Yeah. Well, what you could do with this is tell your parents that you need to get your books for this, and then they pay the full price of the book, and then maybe you can get the money back, and then it's my, you know.
Wow. Then you can spend it on pizza.
On pizza, video games, and all that fun stuff. Check it out, Chegg.com. See if it's for you. Like I said, I'm a little disheartened about it now that Mark dug into it enough. But again, net cost is, if you're going to university anyways, see how much your university is selling these books back to you for. And if you can get it cheaper on Chegg's, then go with that. I mean, you're better off anyways.
Yep.
Chegg.com.
So what do we got next?
What's next, our next thing one? We want to talk about is called the Yahoo Search Pad. And this, apparently they put a demo of this up a while ago. I missed it, and then I saw that they finally officially launched it. And what it does is, as you're searching through Google, it keeps track of the links in your search that you click on and allows you to write notes about it.
Okay.
So, like, the whole point of this is, let's say you're going to research a topic like what I did was, you know, web technology podcast. I wanted to check out some of these. Face Off Show is the first result, which is awesome. So, you know, here in my search pad, it keeps a link, you know, and you can save these search pads and get back to them later and stuff. It's really easy to find them. And the first one is the actual search result. Address that I have.
So I'm looking at your public URL that you sent me, which, so by the way, you can share these.
Yeah, I can share it and send a link to Mark.
So that first Web Tech Podcast, that was your search query to find these?
Yep.
Or was that like a title you came up with for this?
Oh yeah, that was just the title of the search pad note. Like when you want to, when you save it, they ask you what you should call it, and I was like, okay, WebTech Podcast. The first URL in there is the actual search results that I am that search pad is keeping track of for me.
Okay.
And then so I clicked on Face Off Show, and it in search pad it makes a little mark that you know that's where I clicked on it, and then gives me a spot to write notes about it.
So I see you wrote a note, very cool, new web technology podcast, you know.
Uh-huh.
You could also, can you, if you accidentally go to a site that you don't really like, or
yeah,
you know, you read it and you didn't find it very useful, can you either make a note or delete it?
Yeah, yeah. So up over on the site, if you click, there's a little X that you can click delete. If you want, right below the X, there's kind of a little side thing so that you can reorganize them if you want. You know, you don't have to keep it in your chronologically clicking order. If there is an, like a screenshot of the website available, which there wasn't for Face Off, I think I'm not sure what service they use to get screenshots, but you know, it'll show a screenshot on the side for you if you want.
Hmm.
And this makes sense because like if you ever do research on the web, it doesn't really matter. You know, what we tend to do is I'll make a search query and copy and paste, you know, the search query to an email or something. But then when I get searching, I go, well, what were the ones I actually visited? I don't even know. If you're on a different computer, you're like, what were the ones I actually, you know, the search result isn't the super important part. It's what you looked at, you know. And like with this, even if you look at something and you find it's not relevant, you can delete it and you don't need to look at it again.
Yeah, Google's got a search history. It can, you know, show you what you've been searching for and trends in your own little history of search. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really have a place to, at least that I don't know of yet, to store notes about sites that you visited based on that.
Yeah.
Actually, no, I think it does on the right side when you're logged in.
Mm-hmm.
It does, but it's not quite like this. You
can't
really share
it. This is integrated into Yahoo search, mm-hmm. and you can share it. Now, my big complaint is that it's only integrated with Yahoo search. If this was a product that they could somehow make universal for researching, make it just as easy, but make it work with Google or any other search engine or any, you know, just various things, I think it would be a lot more useful. I just don't use Yahoo search.
So can you use this in like a research paper and print it out, or
there's ways to print it, or you can email it to you. I'm not sure how well the formatting is like when you print it, but yeah, I mean, it's designed to write notes about your research and then, you know, share it with people or save it for later.
Okay, when I was referring to the Google way of sending notes, it's actually you can send a comment, a public comment. You click on the icon, one of the icons near the URL, and it'll let you put a comment. So it's a little bit it's not really the same.
Yeah, it's similar. Like if you want to keep notes about websites yourself, you could. But no, is it a public comment?
It's
anyone?
A public comment, so it's not private notes for yourself.
Okay. So I mean, this is something I might share. It doesn't. Yahoo used the same search tech. Didn't they purchase Google search technology? Or
I don't know.
I could have swore that happened. Like, anyways, you know, Yahoo search is good. I just use Google, but it might be something that when I'm doing researching stuff, especially for the show, I might pop into Yahoo so I can test this out and see what I find and what I like.
I could see if you're researching a specific topic, like how to integrate interpreted languages other than PHP with web servers or something, you got some specific category and you go out and you start searching, but you're not just tracking the same keywords all the time. You might be doing web servers in general, and then you want to kind of tie all of that together and then look at all your notes at the end.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you can the nice thing is you can make a public link and share it to somebody. You can say, look at all these sites that I found.
Yeah. Yeah, a similar workflow would be searching and then tagging, you know, on Delicious, tagging everything with like a similar tag, like web something search, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot
but
of
it's not quite as efficient.
I think some people also will make like a bookmark folder and then store a bunch of related sites on that in a bookmark.
Yeah.
But you can't really put notes and things. This so is kind of like, why did I put that in there?
Yeah,
again?
Exactly. You this know? Is a little cleaner, a little more integrated. It has a little more stuff to it, so check it out. It's just, you just actually go to Yahoo and search, and it's there already.
So it's already just on by default.
Yep.
You must be logged in, right? Or
I am logged in. I don't know if you have to be. I could see why, maybe to save it and stuff. I'm sure, but I think you could just use it.
Just make a cookie or something.
Let me sign out and try it. I don't know.
Okay. Looks like they've got. So it's kind of like a. not really an iframe. It's just kind of integrated into the site.
Yeah, right? It's just kind of an Ajax-y little thing on the side that slides out. And so, yeah, you can use SearchPad if you're not logged in.
Okay, cool.
You can't, obviously, you can't really save it or anything, but...
You could, you can you make a public, you could probably make a public link though. That's probably there for a while. I wonder if I can
share it. Let me check here. You have to sign in to do anything special besides just keep notes of it.
Okay.
So, but it is there to use it if you just want to go and plop around and then print it off. No big deal.
Cool.
Yeah, that is the Yahoo SearchPad. So the next web app we're going to talk about.
This next one I'm really excited about.
Yeah, me too. I think it's really cool. It's called CoTweet. So if you go to CoTweet.com, and what it is a interface for managing your company's Twitter accounts with everybody, or not everybody, but multiple people.
So normally, or without something like this, you've got to what give your passwords out to your employees and say if anybody tweets, respond, and then you have no real control over it.
Yeah, so a great example is we have Face Off Show Twitter account. That's a shared Twitter account, really, between me and you. But the whole point is it stands for the entity of Face Off.
Right.
You know, not me, not you, Face Off. And now is you and I both know the username and password. I'm subscribed to the RSS feed for a search for Face Off, so I can reply. But it's very clunky. And then let's say, you know, if we had a company of 12 employees that we all wanted to, you know, make sure that they were addressing customers' concerns on Twitter, we'd have to give that username and password to all of them. And then when, you know, one of them quits or something, we have to change the password and tell everybody. And, you know, it's very clunky.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a way, like you have to give away the passwords and stuff. This is a way to give employees and people privileges to tweet on behalf of the company without giving away the passwords and things. And also you can have multiple entities. Like, you know, we have our personal accounts, but we also want to be able to tweet from Face Off.
Yeah.
The Twitter. So normally we'd have to log out, log back in, see what's going on. You know, we might miss things. It's better to have all of it in one spot.
Yeah, and it's not, again, when it kind of sounds like what we talk about when we say we want a tweet from Face Off, they're thinking like generic tweets. No, we're thinking things like at replies to Face Off or direct messages. We're not talking like, you know, this is where it really shines is when people say something about Face Off or your company and you want to reply to them.
Right.
Either through direct message or through a reply. And what's cool about this is you add people to your organization. It keeps track of who replied to what as long as they do it in CoTweet. So
that's cool.
Yeah. So like earlier, I tweeted something about doing something with Face Off with you, and you logged in and it popped up and said, "Hey, you know, this person mentioned Face Off," and you, Mark Sanborn, replied, and it kept a record of that. You know, so when I go into messages, I could see that. You know, here's our tweet, and view one replied to this. Okay. Oh, I see Mark Sanborn sent a direct message back to this guy talking about it. And this is great because there's a lot of conversation going on in social web about companies and they need to be able to address it. And everyone should be able to. I mean, another really cool thing about it too is as everyone signs in, you really, for each account, you put yourself as on duty.
Yeah. So like if your normal day job is one company and then on the weekend you do another one, you know, you just say you're off duty or on light duty and then you just see the relevant stuff.
Yeah. And as, so like if you're on duty, one of the settings you can have it do is email you when there is a new message that needs to be addressed.
So you could reply right away.
Yeah.
That makes your company look really good.
Yeah. You could leave CoTweet open all the time in your browser or just log in, put yourself on duty.
And just check
and whenever
email.
There's something relevant, which everyone does anyways at work, right?
Right.
Then it's like, oh, okay, I need to address this. But if you're a busy company, let's say there's a lot of jibber jabber on the internet about your company on Twitter, you can just leave it open all the time and address them as they come in.
Yeah. So if you're a company and you've got something and somebody, you know, replies or says something about your, you know, product, says, you know what, I wish, you know, it could do this, you know, you're going to get an email, you're going to go in there and you're going to be able to say, you know, go reply to him and say, hey, you know what? Our product actually does do this. You know, sorry, we, you know, didn't make it more clear.
Exactly.
Or we're working on that. You know, we'll have it on the next version.
And this is like the easiest web-based one that I've found. There are other companies doing this. I have a friend that works at Right Now Technologies here in Bozeman. And they do a really big, powerful enterprise-level CRM. I mean, it's pretty big stuff. And they do something similar. It's called like Cloud Manager, and it has some cool features that this doesn't. But that's a very expensive enterprise level software. Small to medium businesses would not be able to afford it. You know, this is a great solution to manage Twitter. Hopefully, in CodeTweet's future, one of the things that the Right Now one does is it looks at like Twitter and YouTube. It looks at other things.
Yeah.
Hopefully, CodeTweet eventually will integrate it so that you could put your company's Twitter, YouTube and other various things. But
this is perfect for someone like us, where we want to be able to check Faceoff and our own personal accounts without having to log you back in and out.
Exactly.
And then I can see, oh, Jade responded. It wasn't just a random Faceoff. So if we go back in the history, we could see who's been tweeting back and forth. And
exactly. And the interface is unified. So if I go to, if I'm on Faceoff and I click, messages, those are things that mention at Faceoff show. But I could also go to updates and see just all the updates from the people that Faceoff Show is following.
I don't know if they have this feature, but I could see this feature being useful for a larger business, and that is being able to approve messages. If you have employees being able to reply back and forth, or even maybe not necessarily replies, but mainly updates, the actual updates.
Yeah, the big
updates. It would be nice for them to be able to add updates, and then somebody is sitting there and approving or disapproving certain messages.
Yeah.
Bigger company maybe.
Yeah.
But I don't know. They might have PR people that are specialized in that.
Not sure. I mean, if you're a big company's solo Twitter account, but like Google is doing it great. Like every one of their small products has a Twitter account, and it's not, it's something I just hold people responsible for their actions. I think if someone did something stupid, I would reply back and, post on Twitter. And be like, sorry, that guy doesn't work here anymore after doing something like that. I prefer to hold people responsible instead of being overcautious.
That's true.
But some people aren't, and I agree that would be a good feature. It'd be nice if you could almost set permissions. Like, this person is a support specialist, and this person is a marketer, a marketing manager. And support specialists can reply no problem, and, DM customers no problem. But only
but they can't update or
only
something.
The PR guy can send out generic updates or
and
something.
I
yeah.
think they – I'm going to check real quick. Because I do think they do have a permission setting, but I'm not sure what types of access you can set.
Yeah. Another really cool feature is if you have, one of the confusing things is if you have multiple people on one account, they're all replying as this company. How do you know who is who? They support co-tags, which what a co-tag is just kind of like a little tag at the end that lets, usually it's your initials that lets people know maybe that, who you are or that the same person is replying.
Mm-hmm.
So, I can set like my Faceoff Show co-tag to be, a lot of people use Carrot because Carrot kind of sticks out. And so you say like Carrot, JR. And then that way any reply, or tweet that I send out through CodeTweet from Faceoff will have that at the end.
Okay.
Which is great for, so like Faceoff, people know Jade Robbins, Mark Sanborn. They'll be like, oh, Jade sent that, not Mark.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you have all your, if you tell everyone that works in your company, hey, make sure you put this co-tag on it so that people know what's going on at the end.
I see.
So, this company is great. Right now, you can add up to 5 accounts. Like right now, I have Faceoff Twitter and I have Jade Robbins Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I can add up to 5, and then I think there's going to be some clear monetization at the if you want more accounts, if you want more people to have access. But right now it's free and very useful. I like it.
I got to look in the permissions here, and I'm not seeing it's basically admin or just a regular user. I don't see where you can say yes they can do updates and or no they can't do DMs. They might have a pricing structure maybe or something where you could add additional features. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they're going to be working on that in the future.
Yeah.
So
one really quick feature I want to talk about is you can assign tweets to people.
Ooh.
Which is really great. So you can assign things to yourself. Like, let's say if you haven't really factored out a reply yet or anything like that, you assign it to you so people know. Or, if you have a manager, he can assign it to other people saying, I know Mark's in our, our engine, our software design area. I'm going to assign it to him. And, as long as he's using CodeTweet, it's assigned to him and he can log in and say, oh, I need to take care of this.
Yeah, if it's a real technical question, you can send it off to the technical guys. If it's a sales question, you can send it to the sales guys. I could definitely see where that's going to be useful. So.
Yeah. Or you can, email updates and email them too. So let's say someone sent out like a really disturbing, you know, a really angry tweet about your company, you can click on it and hit like, oh, I want to email this tweet and email it to your manager and it'll, you know, send it off to him so he can see what's going on or, you know, very useful. You can, you know, direct message, reply, or you can even retweet someone's tweet, you know, so like, let's say someone says it really good about your company, you can just retweet it out with your corporate account. Very useful. This is a tool you and I were kind of trying to figure out what to do about. Like, we were looking at WordPress plugins so that we could log into WordPress to update Face Off. But I mean, this is what this is designed to do.
Yeah, being able to share accounts without messing with passwords and all that stuff, and be able to have multiple Twitter accounts in one interface is really nice. I know even TweetDeck, which is a very popular client for Twitter, just now added the multiple Twitter accounts, I think.
Yeah.
Although, you know, you'd like to just have one, there's certain reasons, like people that have companies and projects, they mm-hmm. need to have multiple Twitter accounts.
Exactly.
And so this makes it easy.
It's very useful. Yep. CodeTweet.com. I like it. I think we're going to be using that from now on. All right. So let's get into our topics. So the first one, Mark and I hinted at this last week that we wanted to talk about it. It's just called Sinatra. It's a Ruby project, and it's a very, very lightweight Ruby framework. I mean, when you mention Ruby frameworks for the web, basically one thing comes up in people's head.
Rails.
Yeah, exactly. But Rails is a beast. I mean, it's big. It's heavy. It's got a lot of conventions. It's got a lot of things that it'll do for you, which some are very useful. But it's almost like Photoshop sometimes, you know. Not everybody needs all those features.
So, you know, we've got PHP where it's basically just an embedded language inside of HTML. That's just the way it used, you know, PHP is. And then you see this trend where people are starting to do the model view controller where they separate the code from the actual HTML front end. Mm-hmm. And so you can swap out designs real easy. You don't have to muck around with the code.
Yep.
Ruby on Rails is a full MVC framework that does a lot of different stuff for you.
Yeah, it's very, very powerful.
It's got a lot of features, plugins, you know, so authentication. It basically can do almost anything for you, mm-hmm. like real easy.
Being that it uses, you know, Ruby, what it does is it's brought in a lot of really popular Ruby components into Rails. So it's using a lot of these really powerful, really cool Ruby things that just mm-hmm. stand kind of by their own without Rails, but it, you know, integrates them really nicely.
And Ruby and Ruby on Rails is not the only one doing it. There's Python, there's Groovy, and Grails. So the Java side of it, there's Scala. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of different languages, Scala and a bunch of different web frameworks. But Ruby on Rails is getting popular. And we're going to talk about Sinatra, which is a really lightweight version.
Yeah.
It's not really even a framework, so to say.
It
kind of.
Yes, it is. It's a framework. It's not an MVC framework.
Although it could be if you wanted it.
It could be. Yeah, you could do it that way if you want. But so, you know, I know what everybody's saying. Why another web framework? I mean, we've got Rails. We've got, you know, all these. Sinatra is another web framework that's great because it's really small. It has a ridiculously small learning curve. Like I said last week, the second I coded, you know, my first, you know, 10 lines in Sinatra, I was absolutely in love with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a way to get Ruby, just pure writing the Ruby language on the web.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. With like a couple little gotchas in there for you. What's really cool about it, what I like about it, is it's designed around the URL using routes.
Yeah, so, you know, normally in PHP, you're going to be doing stuff like, you can do it different ways, but the traditional old way, I guess, is the question mark and all your query parameters.
Yeah, so with like most PHP apps, and I say most because there's a couple out there like WordPress that do it, but most it's like it's domain slash folder slash folder slash folder, you know, as many folders as you want, slash file name dot PHP, and then the question mark for the query string variables, which is, you know, like ID equals 12. Mm-hmm. So the thing that people are doing now is they're getting rid of the, you know, the folder file name query string, and they're doing what is called routes, which is where they actually use the URL to parse the data. So with Rails, by default, the default route is that the first, you know, folder, quote unquote, in your URL is the model that you want to use. Right. And then the second one is the controller, and the second one is the ID. And then Rails goes through and parses all that for you and makes it usable filtering data.
Right. And you can also do this stuff in PHP.
You can do it by hand, which is kind of very tedious, clunky, I found.
Or you can get an MVC for PHP, Symfony or Xen framework or one of those.
Exactly.
Now, you might be saying, you know, why should I care about the, you know, URLs? Why should I make them like this?
Why would I care?
Well, one of them is if you do it this way, by getting rid of the question marks and the extensions, the .php, the .py for Python, .rb or
ASP,
ASP.html,
XP,
ASP.x, question mark, ID or whatever, it makes changing technologies really easy. If you do your entire site in, like, let's say, .php, and you've got .php, question mark, and a bunch of query strings, and now all of a sudden you're like, you know what, we're going to do this web app, you know, on our site that requires a lot of Python stuff. You would have to pretend, like, all your URLs are mapped to .php. So you would either have to do a bunch of mod rewrites to change the URL
for search engine optimization to
keep your page rank and also to keep your backlinks that people have already linked to your site. You would either have to go in and change all of them to look, instead of PHP, they'd have to go look at .python or whatever. Mm-hmm. By just making the folder structure, although I say folder, but it's really not that. Okay. So anyways, by doing it that way, you don't have any extensions related to it. You don't have any question mark, query string things. Mm-hmm. And so changing from Python to Ruby or whatever, you just map it to that URL. The underlying technology doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because you're hiding it.
Yeah, because it's the sort of the URL structure is dynamically created with your app. It's not based on folders or anything. So if, you know, you started with a technology that said, you know, the first slash is my category and the second slash is my article ID, that maps over to another application. Then you're like, okay, well, that's great. Then I can do the same thing, but with a different technology, instead of having to mimic a folder structure like with PHP or just HTML by default.
Yeah.
Which also a huge part of SEO is your URL, the address. It's, you know, if you have just, you know, jrobbins.com/12, which is my category ID, /1, which is my post ID, that will get a much lower rank than jrobbins.com/the actual category name/the actual article name. That's much more important for SEO.
Yeah, part of the reason is, well, originally Google was afraid kind of to get their Google bots too deep into a website. And so they kind of avoided query strings at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Now they figured it out and they can get pretty deep through them, and it doesn't really matter too much on that part of it. But what it does matter is if you've just got something like ID equals one, Google doesn't really, it has to rely on only the page title and the keywords in it. It can't rely on the URL. Yeah, so
it reinforces the content of the page almost.
Yeah. By doing it this way, you can actually have keywords inside your URL. Mm-hmm. And Google actually weighs those fairly heavily.
Yeah. And it's just nicer. I mean, doing URLs this way, they're easier to remember and they just look nice. I mean, there's no big strings of numbers or anything, you know, it's just, you know, jrobbins.com/, and then my article title, you know, with no spaces. It's easy to remember.
Easy to remember. Looks nice.
Looks great.
So Sinatra makes doing this super easy.
Yeah.
You've already, I mean, you by definition of how Sinatra works, you've got clean URLs and you're ready to start just coding Ruby in it.
So Sinatra, the base of Sinatra is that you define things restfully, which REST is a standardized protocol for manipulating information on the web. The standard one that everyone uses is GET. A GET call is when you go to an address and you hit enter, that's a GET. Your web browser is saying to the web server, get this, bring it back. Another one is POST. Anytime you submit a form, your browser is putting a POST RESTful call to post data to this website. The other two is
update
and delete are the two RESTful calls. Most web browsers don't do that by standard, but
They do it through post, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. There's like a hack around that every modern browser kind of understands. But the whole point of Sinatra is, so when you want to write a Sinatra app, you say what the RESTful call is that you want it to be, such as get, you know, the average get, and then you put the route that you want. So like get, if the Sinatra website has a really small example, it's like three lines or five lines of code for a working app.
Right.
You'd say get, you know, slash high, and then do, and then what you want that URL to do. And then you say end. And so when I go to with this web app slash hi, it says, okay, this is a get call for slash hi. Do this code.
So with three lines of code, you can type in Ruby and the name of the file, and you've got a web server that's hosting that on your local domain. So you've already got a test integration testing, right? You know,
yeah.
You're ready to test. So you browse to your website and you get to see it.
Yep, exactly.
So it comes with a web server. You don't have to mess around with, you know, LAMP, installing mm-hmm. Apache and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So
it requires, you know, a gem installation through Ruby. That's it. And the other cool part about this is it's great for web apps too, but being that it is designed around RESTful calls makes it perfect for to do an API. So, I mean, any little Dinkmeyer website could make a fully functional API using Sinatra and its RESTful calls. So, you know, if you want to do an API for a third-party program to access your website, there you go. You know, get, post, update, delete, and for each item.
Yeah, this just makes it really easy. I mean, if you wanted to do something like this in PHP, I mean, by hand, it would take a while.
Exactly.
You could install one of the MVC frameworks, but it might be overkill.
Yeah.
You know, installing something like Rails might be overkill for a simple app.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's got a lot of overhead as far as, you know, your computer wise, but it's also got a very thick learning curve. I mean, I'm Rails still confuses me. Sinatra I got and was writing in 5 minutes. I mean, yeah, I'd
be fairly confident to say that if you were fairly new to Ruby, you could still do it in about an hour just doing reading the tutorial on this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it supports, you can put variables inside your routes if you want, similar to like Rails, you know, how the first slash is your, model. Well, you could do that in Sinatra if you want to. You can say that I want slash, you know, comic book stores slash in the, and then you put, you know, the variable colon, name. And so then people can have dynamic URLs just like any other web app that uses, you know, routes like this.
And this is fully Rack compatible, so you can just deploying it on a web host is fairly straightforward.
Yeah.
When you are ready, when your app is done and you're ready to publish it to the
world. Have we talked about Rack before?
I think we might have mentioned it maybe.
Yeah. Rack. So Rack kind of confuses me. But what I have found is that if you have a Rack-compatible web server, what I'm told is if you have a Rack-compatible web server and a Rack-compatible application, it doesn't matter. They'll mesh and load. So, you know, Rails is really popular. So a lot of people have been, a lot of hosts support Passenger, which is a sort of enterprise scalable way to deploy Rails applications. Passenger is Rack-compatible. So any web host that has Passenger for doing Rails, you can throw a Sinatra app onto it.
Yeah. You know, PHP is really easy to get on a server. They pretty much have it all on by default. Exactly. But sometimes hosts don't always have, you know, Ruby set up.
Yep.
But it's changing, and it's becoming Rack. Things like Rack and Passenger, Mod Passenger, are making things, making it easier to get Ruby going on a web host. I know our host that we like, you know, supports it.
Yeah.
So
yeah, we both use DreamHost, and DreamHost supports you can do a Passenger instance. And so then you can throw Sinatra on it, no problem. What are some of the other cool things? It supports layouts and supports views.
It doesn't really pigeonhole you anything. If you want to use a certain template, you know, you can use it. If you don't even want to use a template, you don't have to.
Yeah.
But if you want to use some kind of a template engine, you can use, you know, Haml or ERB mm-hmm. or, you know.
Yeah. I found actually on GitHub, some guy wrote a pasty clone in Sinatra, and he wrote it all in one file.
Wow.
It's
like a paste bin kind of program?
Paste bin, yeah, exactly.
Wow.
One file. I mean, that's great.
Yeah.
That's super smart. And it's just so easy to use. I mean, you and I hopped onto it and were playing around and tinkering around with it in no time. It was really easy to learn.
Yeah, with Rails, Rails is great. I'm not dogging on Rails. It's just I'm not quite there yet to just start going at it.
Yeah,
you know?
Me too.
I feel I could go at it. I have enough knowledge to be dangerous. I could start going at it and start programming stuff, but I would find myself not doing it, you know, the Rails way.
Yeah, exactly.
There is no really way with Sinatra. You just do your thing. You know, it might not be the best, you know, way to do it, but at least you can get up and running. And
yeah. Going. I mean, you sacrifice all the stuff that Rails does for you for having the flexibility to do it the way you want and doing it without having to learn all the Rails goo. There's a lot of Rails goo to learn.
Yeah, there's you don't have to dig through API pages or anything. It's just, it's so straightforward that, like I said, an hour and you're off to the races.
And it does support HAML, which we're going to talk about in a later episode. But it's basically an HTML templating language. There's a lot of them that Sinatra supports. It supports HAML, ERB, Builder, SAS, I believe, for CSS.
And basically, all those are just a way to embed your Ruby, but they do some extra things for you that makes it even easier to write HTML.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It's funny. I think I'm just one of those people. I really don't like the file name dot whatever at the end of an address. It just really has always bugged me.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, for the longest time there, I thought it was kind of difficult to do in PHP. So I was always thinking of ways to use WordPress as a CMS to get around it and stuff. But this is a way for me to make websites which with very eloquent URLs that I can do in no time.
Mm-hmm. So. That, I mean, that's pretty much it. It's very simple. It's not.
But, so, I mean, whilst we're talking about Sinatra, too, this is also a trend. It seemed like there was just basic scripting, like PHP, basic Ruby, basic Python, and then we came out with these really hardcore frameworks like Rails and Django, you know, and there's some pretty hardcore MVC, like CakePHP and PHP. And now we're seeing people, you know, this hardcore push at the end. We're seeing these kind of meet in the middle frameworks, which give you the help, you know, some help to make things easier, but without this really hardcore learning curve. Like you were playing around with a Python version of this sort of middle framework called web.py.
Yeah, web.py is so if you know Python a lot and you don't want to learn Ruby right now, Python is basically. Web.py is basically the Sinatra for Python.
Yeah, you very similar syntax. I mean,
you import the Python module, you set up your URLs. So in this one, you don't set up your URLs in the class. It's a separate deal. But other than that, it's exactly the same as Sinatra. You've got your default Git, put, and all that stuff.
Yeah, your RESTful calls.
And you just you put in your Python code and write it up, and then you've got a template, set up for you too, and then you've got it.
Yeah, and I know what some people might be thinking. They're saying, "Well, okay, Jade, Mark, you're telling me about web.py, you're telling me about Sinatra. You know, no one's using those." the truth is, there are some big names using both of these,
right?
For Sinatra, I mean, like GitHub, it was actually written by a guy from GitHub, I believe.
Wow.
So GitHub uses a lot of Sinatra, and GitHub's pretty intense, which is great because you get the flexibility of writing, you know, web applications, you know, quickly and easily, but you also have like that console power of a good, powerful scripting language behind it, like Ruby or Python.
Sure.
There's some real big names using web.py too, correct?
Reddit uses web.py.
Whoa.
Yeah, Reddit? Reddit is a very large website there.
There's a lot of stuff going on at Reddit.
Reddit's a social media site, kind of like Dig or StumbleUpon or a social media outlet. And Reddit uses web.py with the Lighty web server.
That's
and
crazy.
And so they, I mean, and you know, Reddit is open source, and we're going to include, you know, a link to that. You can actually check out their code. You can see their web.py, you know, how they made it. You can see how they made Reddit in web.py.
Yeah, that's cool. We were looking at it, and I was like, oh, I understand this because I've been playing with Sinatra. I get what's going on here.
So basically, I guess the point is these are two case studies for using these tools, and you can make some pretty nice web apps. I mean, Reddit is huge, and they're using Web.py, so it's like a case study for it. You know, GitHub, there's a lot of people using GitHub, and, you know, I don't know if Sinatra is totally, you know, the main framework that GitHub uses, but I think they're fairly involved.
Yeah, it you know, it says it's using it. I don't know how extensively, but I mean, that's the great part about Sinatra is you also don't have to use it for a website app if you don't want to. You could use it as an API app. So, I mean, you could have a website that's cranking in Rails, but then let's say you want to just make a really, you know, anything going through Rails has to go through all that Rails goo, you know, to spit stuff out. Well, let's say you just want a really, really light API that, you know, you don't want to have to do a lot of Rails stuff in, then pop Sinatra, lump it on next to it, and let it do the API for you.
Yep.
You know? So check it out. I'm curious. It's not written the same way, but Zend, I thought you said, was, for PHP, was kind of like this too, wasn't it? It was, you know, kind of like not a full-fledged MVC framework. It was more like, you know, get an application up quickly.
Well, you know, looking at these, Zend is not like, you know, super lightweight, just, you know, set up the routes and you're pretty much away you go. Mm-hmm. Zend is more like a library.
Oh, okay.
You know, if you want a way to, you know, validate credit card numbers using the Loon algorithm, they've got it already coded. You just pass the parameters into their function.
Oh, okay.
Zend, you don't have to use a model view controller at all. They have a library to set up MVC if you want it. So it's basically, it's almost like Pear or something.
Oh, okay.
You've got the Zend folder, and then you just call functions out of it.
Oh, okay. Okay, so it's just like almost like a library of helpers.
Yeah, it's as lightweight or as heavy as you kind of want it to be.
Okay.
So, but not necessarily like these.
Yeah, so I mean, if anybody knows of a PHP framework
that does
that
like
is
this,
like Sinatra, because
that would be awesome.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I like coding in PHP too, and so if I could get this easy routing in PHP, oh man, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're always like, oh, let's learn the new cool thing, but you know, so a lot of times if you're doing freelance work and stuff, clients are wanting it in PHP because that's what their entire website's created in.
Yeah. And it's just a buzzword they know. You know, they hear, you know.
And their host is already set up for it.
It can go either way. Sometimes they're like, I heard Rails. I want Rails.
That's true, too.
You know. But
chances are their host is set up for PHP. They're already ready to go. If you had some sort of something like this for PHP, you could just plug it in and start going. It would make your job a lot easier.
Yeah. So if anyone knows of that, let us know, because I want to hear about it.
And if your routes were done, you know, with something like that in PHP, if you wanted to switch then to Python or Ruby later on,
yeah,
you don't have to mess with the URL.php or any of that stuff. It's you can change over a little bit easier.
Exactly. Yeah, because you'll have your route rules set up already. That's the best part about it.
You have to rewrite a lot of the code, but the URLs, you won't have to do a whole lot of mod rewriting on those.
Yeah. So check it out, Sinatra, web.py, and if anyone knows of this this elusive PHP one that we need, let us know, because I want to play around with it.
Yeah, we'll do a follow. If we find one, we'll do a follow-up on it and let you guys know.
All right, Mark, let's do the second little topic we're going to do is we're going to kind of go back. A while ago, we did a quick look at the web dosanddonts.com.
Yeah, I think it was like episode 17 or something. We talked about them.
It was episode 17. So we're going to go back and do it and do some of the newest ones. Last time we just picked intermediate, but we're going to do just the newest ones this time and kind of go through the list and spit out our little comments about each one of them. So the newest on web do's and don'ts right now, the first do is use a fav icon.
Absolutely.
It's so easy. There's so many web apps out there that will make it for you. Just put it up there. It makes it look a million times more professional.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure all the browsers that people are using for the most part you know, support it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just make a tiny little logo or something and then use one of the generators online or something and make one. It's not bad.
Well, especially now with, I mean, every browser supports tabs and every browser's little tab has the little fav icon right next to it. So it's a quick way to identify the site in a list of tabs. You have to get it done. I actually,
it's way to brand.
Somehow
it's
removed. I think I screwed up when I was working on Montana Fragfest and deleted the fav icon, and I don't have a backup. So I have to get that backup because it bugs me every time I go to it. I'm like, oh, I need to do that. The first don't is don't make browsers guess which encoding the page uses. I'm really kind of a noob when it comes to encoding and stuff. So why is this important?
Well, it's first important to define what encoding is. Computers, you know, as we all kind of know, computers only know ones and zeros. So how do you represent like the A character? Well, it's a certain series of ones and zeros. And there's different types of encoding for different languages. ASCII is probably the most common one. Mm-hmm. And that's just, you know, upper and lowercase letters that don't really have any, you know, accent markings.
No umlauts or...
So what their thing is, I guess, is if you need to specify an encoding, you know, don't let the browser guess, or you could get some weird like question marks and things on your page.
I've seen this happen.
Especially if you use accent characters like, you know, in jalapeno or something like that, where you have a special character. You know, some web browsers will, if you don't specify the encoding, your users will come to that through their web browser, and they're going to see like a question mark there in replace of that character.
Like a goofy square sometimes and stuff. Yeah, where this happens a lot is with quotation marks. Oh, so,
yeah, the single quote, there's weird single quote ones.
Well, the single quote, but like with double quotes, some encodings support two quotes. There's the, you know, beginning quote and the end quote.
Yeah.
And if your browser doesn't support that, your quotes look goofy, you know, whereas like I think standard ASCII is just one quote, you know, they just look the same, but like the special ones, like they turn in towards the thing and they look different. Again, it's a minor thing. You see a lot of people, you can tell when they write their content in like Word or something and paste it over. Yeah. Yep. The encoding gets goofed up on that a lot.
I've seen that firsthand. So
know your encoding. All right. The next do is improve your web typography. This is important. You were telling me, I think, a while ago, if there's, you know, messing with like your margins and your character spacing a little bit can make your website immensely more readable. What?
Yeah, the first time I noticed it was I was on ProBlogger's website, and you know, I think I might have even messaged you, and I was like, there's something about this site that makes it really easy to read compared to my site. Mm-hmm. There's something here, and it's not the writing style. There's something the way it's laid out. Mm-hmm. And I later found this article on Smashing Magazine that talks about your typography and your line spacing. And that's what it was. It was line spacing. Mm-hmm. His lines had a little bit more spacing, and it was easier to read.
Yep.
So we'll talk about a little bit of some of these. So measure, and that's like the length of the text. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, depending on the length of the content, you sometimes will want a shorter measure in your typography. It makes it look nicer.
Yeah, people don't like long lines. They don't like to read long lines.
Yeah,
if
you have like a really short paragraph that's only like, you know, if you extend it way out, it's going to be on like one line, and you're going to have to like move your head because it's such a long line.
Watch your liquid layouts, man.
Leading. This is where you have a paragraph, and then, you know, at the end of the line, you hit enter or whatever, and you have, you know, big blocks of spaces.
Mm-hmm.
You got to kind of watch that.
Yeah. Well, I agree completely. Things like, also it mentions here, you know, emphasis, you know, make sure you're emphasizing things correctly. You're not leaving hanging quotes. Just, you know, look at the typography. It's important. I agree.
Yeah. Another one is like vertical rhythm. This kind of follows the principles of like a grid layout. Your text should follow a certain... if you've got a title, a certain spacing, and then you have the paragraph, you space it down a little bit, and then you've got another subheading or something, it needs to follow a certain grid pattern. Yep. Otherwise, it looks funny.
Yeah, it doesn't look consistent. It looks wonky. I agree.
So, all
right. So the next don't is don't overuse Ajax, and this is a biggie. I mean, if Ajax, you have to be really careful with because, it's kind of a goofy thing. If you don't do it right, there's things going on in the background that the user doesn't know about. And if there's too much going on, it can be really slow and things get goofy. It gets out of sync. And, you know, you got this whole site doing all this crazy gunk and all you want to do is read text. You know, it's just too much.
Yeah. You know, even with like these netbooks that don't have a whole lot of processing power, if you've got the site just loaded with JavaScript, you know, and the user tried to scroll up and down and things, the site can sometimes get really choppy and slow.
Yeah.
I've seen this a lot. And, you know, JavaScript's a great technology. It helps us do a lot of different things, but, you know, sometimes it can slow down the site. So you got to be aware of that.
Yep. The next do is keep your users updated during the loading. And this is important. Again, if you have a lot of Ajax, there's things going on in the background. The Ajax is not, it doesn't by the browser that it's doing anything. It just is. Mm-hmm. And you need to keep the user apprised of that. Let them know that, you know, when they click something that it's thinking and trying to contact the server and do it, you know, an operation via Ajax or...
Yeah, this can be loading. Like a scrolling, a scrolling circle, you know, a rotating circle. The Google keyword tool that we talked about last episode showed four little Google balls going from left to right.
Yeah, it was almost like they tipped the jar and the balls would go like ding 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 down. And yeah,
so some way to let your users know that you're doing something and just wait for a minute.
Yeah, or even just graying out the text, like graying out the text and making it not clickable. You know, is enough to usually to warn people that it's doing something in the background. But the better and more accurate you're notifying the user, the happier that will be. Okay, our next don't is. Don't use XML declaration in IE6. So I looked this up, and apparently if you use the XML declaration for XHTML, mm-hmm. like, you know, at the top you say XML version 1.0, it runs this in Internet Explorer in Quirks mode, which Quirks mode is like this, it's like a goofy mode that browsers have to basically take care of all the goofy hacks that people did in the past to make their website run. And so specifically, if you use the XML declaration in Quirks mode, it uses the wrong CSS template, so it'll goof up your CSS, and you'll wonder why. I mean, Internet Explorer goofs up your CSS
anyways.
But this way, it'll definitely, you know, it loads like a really old version of the CSS loader with a bunch of goofy hacks enabled and stuff. So just it's bad news.
So is it better to use like HTML 4.01 or? You know, like or strict or transitional or
them. I'm not sure what would be the best to use, but just make sure if you're putting in and if you're aware of it, I think that being aware of Internet Explorer 6 and still not supporting it is okay. It has a very significant market share, but my personal opinion is I'm not supporting Internet Explorer 6. You know, I think people need to get off that horse. but if you decide that you want to, then you need to look at those options and maybe do a different doc type for your webpage.
All right, a good do, something you should be doing is provide a good contact page, you know.
Yep. Let people know how to give feedback and get a hold of you. I mean, that's...
It also shows that you're credible. You're not trying to hide from anything.
Exactly.
You know.
If you're a company with offices, I mean, if someone wanted to, they can come to your office and check it out. You might not want them to, but at least they could drive by and say, oh, you know, this business does exist. It's not a Nigerian scammer.
I would suggest putting the link to the contact page in a few different places. One of them that a lot of people tend to look is the bottom footer.
Yep, footer.
And sometimes top right, but definitely the bottom footer. And then even it can be in your main navigation, mm-hmm. but you should maybe put it in the bottom footer as well, mm-hmm. just to make it
easy. Or the about us section. I usually look for it yep. in if I'm looking for it. So, just but I think the footer's a good spot.
Make it easy to find.
Yeah, that's where people look. The next don't is don't use CSS hacks. And this is a really good tip because things are changing all the time. Standards are changing. New versions of browsers are coming out. And a hack that you might have to use for one version might totally break it in the next. And it's just easier to plan your CSS out well and not have to use goofy hacks to get around it.
This don't kind of got a bad review, a ranking of people seeing this, and I'm guessing it's because sometimes you have to hack something, especially to get like IE6 to work and things.
Yeah,
but I think the overall is like try not to do it.
Yeah,
you know, try to code to standards, and for like IE6 for example, if use like that JavaScript code that we talked about that mm-hmm. that makes IE6 act like IE7, use something like that more than a hack.
Yeah,
because you know when people do decide to go from IE6 to IE7 or 8. You know, you won't need as many of the hacks, and mm-hmm. they'll probably do more harm than good.
And hacks are not standard. They're not part of the standard. And if a browser comes out and it's very standard, strict next version, it's just going to break. And you should try and use standards anyways and encourage it. If you want to use a hack, go ahead. But I think a lot of people are using these hacks to just to really do things that a browser was not intended to do. And if you want that and you want to maintain that, that's fine. It's just be forewarned that there's a high probability it might not come around. It might come and bite you in the rear in the future.
So the next do we have is optimize web graphics.
You're totally into this. I know this is an interesting one because I am not. I don't. I assume that, you know, if my... I don't need to, I don't use HTML resize very often. But I mean, I assume as long as I resize my image in size it should be, I think it's good enough personally.
Well,
you lossless well, I'm one JPEG of the, compression so that, you know,
I like to tweak it as much as possible to get the optimal performance and everything. You know, where this is really going to come into play is when you have a super popular site or a site that has tons
That's
of
true.
Images.
Very true.
Basically, the tips I can give here is the first one is know which format is best to use when and where. GIFs and PNG are typically better for images that have very few colors, like logos, a lot of web graphics, navigation stuff. If you're going to put an image of, you know, a photograph or something that has thousands or millions of colors, you're going to want to maybe use JPEG. Hmm. It's better at that. And then there's tools. A lot of people use, you know, like Adobe's Save to Web feature to compress images, and that does a fairly decent job. There are programs like PNG Crush and JPEG Tran that will further compress with no quality changes.
Yeah. I even read this crazy article where the guy was like talking about lining up the pixels in your image to make sure that there's less transitional colors and stuff. It was hardcore.
Wow.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you're trying to save on bandwidth, or, you know, a lot of your, you know, demographic, your target market are people with, you know, dial up connections or something like that, or slower broadband connections, you're going to want to make them optimize. And really you're going to want to make them optimize all the time, but sometimes it doesn't justify to go back and change thousands of images.
Yeah. Let's say, I mean, something like JPEG Tran, you know, if you have a large repository of images, you could write a bash script to go through and do right. it all for you automatically. But, you know, if you're just doing a lot of quick stuff, you know, boom, 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 sometimes it's, I personally don't think it's worth the time. I just go and I just save it enough so that, you know, it's not a bitmap. It is compressed, and that's good enough for me. But again, like you said, if I had a really high traffic website, you're going to be trying eking out as much of that bandwidth as possible. So, you know, especially things like layout images and stuff, really go through and compress those well, because those are going to be loading a lot every time, you know.
Yep.
So the last don't is don't use Justify exclusively.
So Justify, you know, you see it a lot in newspapers. It's kind of where they want to make the left side and the right side of the block of text even.
Yep.
And so they'll put spacing between words. Sometimes, you know, it'll be regular spacing, and sometimes there's only a couple words on the line, and they'll have a big space between the words.
Yeah. So this is why you shouldn't use it. Like, so the example in this website here is, you know, it's literally two little four-letter words on one line, and the rest is this giant gap.
Yeah, so they're saying, you know, use Justify, makes things look nice, but be careful, especially in really skinny columns. Mm-hmm. But be careful of making big holes in the text. Yeah, it doesn't look good.
You're gonna have to find. You're gonna have to probably want to fine tune your content or fine tune your width to make sure that doesn't happen. But you're just gonna have to check it out much more actively than just using, you know, left or right justified text.
Yep.
All right, well, that does it for this episode of Face Off Show. I want to remind you guys that if you want to subscribe, you can go to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. You can also leave feedback for the show by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. There's all kinds of feedback. If you have some follow-up for us to check out, if you have some web apps you want us to look at or a topic you want us to discuss, leave us some feedback, and, you know, we always get back to you guys. So we really appreciate it, and we'll see you guys next week.